We really feel like Spain was needing another tool, but like a really powerful emotional tool to be able to discuss, for families to talk about it, for people to bring their parents into the theaters. Theaters keep filling out. We're already in our fourth week in theaters, and there's been viral videos that are seen millions of times. So it's been a really amazing and beautiful moment.
We have to leave it there.
Bring the film into the people.
I thank you so much. Almudena Carracedo, Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, together with Robert Behar, produced and directed The Silence of Others. Thank you so much.
KABU Community Radio is hiring a development director. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the anti-oppression work of KABU. Send a cover letter and resume to Delphine Crescenzo at del@kabu.org or send to KABU Development Hire, 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please answer in the cover letter the question, why is KABU important? More information on the development director position is available at kabu.fm/developmenthire2018.
It's another big give day through the Willamette Week Give Guide. If you haven't had a chance to give to KABU, today is the day to do it.
Donate at kboo.fm/give today for a chance to win a Sony RX100 VA mirrorless camera from Pro Photo Supply.
If you're 35 or under, you have an even better chance to win. A second camera will be raffled off to one donor under the age of 36.
Your investment today matters. KABU needs your support to broadcast and archive the voices, conversation, and artistry of our community.
Go to kboo.fm/give to contribute now.
Support KABU,
where music makes the movement.
KBOO Portland, the time is 5:01 and, well, 5:02 now. Up next is your evening news with Grace Anna and Annette.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Evening News, a man who used to live in Portland found guilty of abusing young children in a case lawyers describe as one of the worst they've ever seen.
Three tracksuit bandits get prison time for a crime spree in Multnomah and Clackamas counties.
And warming shelters are opening in our community as people get ready for temperatures to drop below freezing overnight, where the houseless can go for help.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, December 6, 2018. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Annette Newell. Trigger warning for the following report contains graphic content about sexual violence. After deliberating for just 20 minutes, a federal jury decided on a guilty verdict against a former Portland resident, 44-year-old Andrew Kowalczyk, for sexually abusing three children he was babysitting. Lawyers say he subjected female victims as young as two to sex abuse and exploitation for child porn. Billy Williams, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Oregon, says his action, quote, brought in unthinkable distress and terror to the lives of his victims and their families. He says prosecutors described it as the worst conduct they've ever seen in their careers and accused Kowalczyk of using every tactic he could to delay justice for more than 10 years. According to court documents, police first learned of Kowalczyk's abuse in early 2008. Detectives got a warrant to search computer equipment, a digital camera, and digital storage devices in Kowalczyk's luggage. They found a tremendous amount of child pornography with videos and images showing a male sexually abusing two very young children. The victim's mother recognized the victims from police photos and called detectives. She confirmed she knew Kowalczyk and that he'd had regular access to her daughters in Portland. She told investigators she met Kowalczyk, a friend of her deceased brother, in 2003. In 2005, after the victim's mother and her children wound up in a domestic violence shelter, Kowalczyk offered to pay for them to stay in Portland motels. The victim's mother left her children in Kowalczyk's care while she searched for work or housing. She had believed he treated the victims well, buying them clothing, diapers, shoes, and even a birthday cake, and was unaware of the abuse. He faces a maximum sentence of 30 years in prison on 9 counts.
Three men police call the Tracksuit Bandits are admitting to a long list of robberies in Multnomah and Clackamas counties. Today, the Multnomah County's DA announced the men changed their pleas in circuit court. 21-year-old Kobe Cordray pleaded no contest to attempted murder and robbery and was given a 16-year prison sentence. 20-year-old Lamar Lester Jr. pleaded guilty to robbery and was given a 14-year sentence. Angelo Lester, 18, pleaded no contest to robbery and received more than 8 months in prison. From December 9th of last year to January 21st of this year, a crew of armed robbers committed 9 robberies in Portland and Gresham. The robbers wore masks to hide their faces and used guns to steal cash and other items from convenience stores and would leave in a white Ford Excursion. Detectives named the group Tracksuit Bandits because they wore matching tracksuits to each of the robberies. These individuals, because of their actions, caused a lot of fear in our community, Multnomah County Senior Deputy District Attorney David Hannon said. Other officers believe the Tracksuit Bandits were responsible for robberies including Rounders in Gresham, 2 Smoker Zone stores in Portland, the Sunny Corner Market in Milwaukee, and Food King in Northeast Portland. In January, they found 3 men in a white SUV that matched descriptions from robberies. The traffic stop happened shortly after one of the robberies on Northeast Sandy Boulevard. Officers found stolen items and a loaded handgun.
The Joint Office of Homeless Services has reviewed the weather forecast for Multnomah County, and while conditions do not meet severe weather thresholds, overnight temperatures are predicted to be at or below freezing. The following winter shelters are available in Portland: the Union Gospel Mission on Northwest 3rd Avenue, the Dignity Village Warming Shelter on Sunderland Avenue, the Walnut Park Winter Shelter on Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, the North Portland Winter Shelter at Portsmouth Church on North Lombard Avenue, Rose City Park United Methodist Church Winter Shelter on Northeast Alameda Street, and the Family Winter Shelter in Northwest Portland. And the Columbia County Warming Center is also open tonight on North 17th Street in St. Helens.
Danielle James, a member of Black Lives Matters and a leader of Occupy ICE, was charged with assaulting a cameraman during last summer's protest of ICE in downtown Portland. KBOO's Teresa Mitchell attended and brought us this piece from the press conference before her trial.
My name is Danielle James. Some of you may know me as an activist for Black Lives Matter, as a leader and organizer for the Occupy ICE movement. I feel I have a moral obligation to speak up for those who have been denied a voice. I'm seeking justice for people of color in this city. I'm calling out the inhumane policies of separating families at the border. In October of last year, a leaked report from the FBI categorized black activists as a domestic threat, coining the term black identity extremists. This has opened the door for the FBI to target black activists while justifying the criminalization and surveillance of black people in general. As this repression takes the stage, an infamous and ongoing series of assaults by right-wing and white identity extremists has gone largely unpublished. This city continues to welcome white extremists whose speech truly has incited violence on our streets. Today, I'm facing charges that are leveled at me in retaliation for my activism and dissent. There is no hope of factually or logically proving that I engaged in abusive, assaultive behavior. And indeed, there is a body of video and audio evidence that shows that I did not. Instead, the local media, capitalists, the police, and the court hope to silence my dissent by bringing charges that they hope I cannot counter for lack of economic resources. This court represents an attack on free speech. It is an attempt to intimidate all those who would stand up against injustice by using the streets to petition their government for redress of grievances. It is another blow in a series of 500 years of oppression against all those who stand in the way of brutal business as usual. I have led activists to the best of my ability to bring attention to the inhumane and illegal practice tearing children away from their desperate and grieving parents. I will not cease in my efforts until this injustice is banned from our government and our society.
Abolish ICE!
Abolish ICE!
Abolish ICE!
That was Danielle James, a local activist, speaking at a press conference before appearing in court on charges of assault.
A trigger warning now for our listeners. The following story contains details of what may have been a hate crime. In May of this year, the badly injured body of Aaron Salazar, a student from Portland State University, was found around the train tracks in Truckee, California. Aaron Salazar was returning to Portland after visiting Colorado. The last text he had sent from his phone was to his grandmother, telling her that he had a layover and was going to eat lunch with a new friend. Within hours, his body was discovered with a broken pelvis, burns to his groin, and brainstem damage. Since the incident occurred on Amtrak property, it was handled by Amtrak police instead of the local law enforcement division. They concluded that Salazar had attempted suicide. However, his family claims that isn't possible. They say that investigators never even spoke with them while determining what had happened or even directly examined Salazar's body. They feared that he had been the victim of a hate crime for being gay. Aaron Salazar has recently woken up from his coma and is now reassuring the public that he did not attempt suicide. He recently released a statement that said, quote, "I wanted to thank everybody for the love and support and the prayers and the letters. I want you all to know I did not jump off the train. I never even tried to kill myself," end of quote. Salazar says he does not remember the event, but KBOO will be following this story closely as it develops.
Leaders in the Oregon legislature will turn over documents relating to sexual harassment claims after the Oregon Appeals Court threw out their appeal. Brad Avakian, the Commissioner of Oregon's Bureau of Labor and Industries, filed subpoenas to release all documents relating to harassment over an 8-year period following complaints against former Republican State Senator Jeff Cruz, who resigned in February. Lawmakers, including Senate President Peter Courtney and House Speaker Tina Kotek, were appealing on November 19th decision from Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Christopher Marshall that the documents must be released. Courtney and Kotek said they were concerned about protecting the confidentiality of victims. However, Avakian accused fellow Democrats Courtney and Kotek of allowing a sexually hostile environment and of being slow to protect women from Cruz.
Climate Connections highlights issues arising from climate change and what people are doing about it. On today's episode, how climate change denial is affecting conversations teachers have with their students.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Teachers across the country have no qualms explaining the facts of physics or chemistry. And according to the National Science Teachers Association, climate change should not be any different.
The controversies surrounding climate change are not scientific arguments. They are social arguments, economic, political arguments.
Eric Pyle of James Madison University in Virginia says we can debate what to do about climate change, but the underlying science is clear.
When you talk to scientists, and climate scientists in particular, they're not arguing about whether it's happening or not.
Pyle chaired an NSTA panel that recently developed a statement in support of teaching climate science in K-12 classrooms.
It adds a lot of clarity to teachers about the role of climate change and what should be taught.
The statement includes resources teachers can use to develop lessons and curricula on the topic.
NSTA didn't just put a statement out to say, okay, now this is what we believe in. but it's also to say we have the resources that can provide the professional learning to build teacher content knowledge and to help build their confidence to address these socially controversial topics in the classroom.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
CurrentCast is a daily piece highlighting issues affecting our fresh water. On today's episode, an insight into PESCO linguistics.
Fish Talk on this CurrentCast. When Aaron Rice eavesdrops on a conversation, he hears plenty of pops, purrs, clicks, and grunts. As research associate at the Bioacoustics Research Program at Cornell University, he listens to fish. The sounds usually have something to do with aggression or reproduction, and some are loud.
And you can hear them just honking away as the males protect their nests and try to attract females to them.
Other sounds are too quiet for human ears, but fish are built for underwater hearing.
They are 85% water, and so sound waves travel through them pretty readily.
Rice and others use the sound to learn more about fish habits and to track their distribution. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley is sponsoring a bill that would make drug companies foot part of the bill for the opioid epidemic and crisis. The Opioid Treatment Surge Act would require opioid manufacturers to contribute $2 billion over the next 10 years to help fight the crisis. In a statement, Senator Merkley said drug companies flooded the streets with massive quantities of opioids to enrich themselves, while a generation of Americans got hooked. It is time for those companies to commit a portion of those profits to dramatically increase treatment capacity to address this crisis. Under the bill, it's estimated that each state will receive a block grant increase of about 110%.
The Bureau of Land Management has approved an exploratory mining venture in the Gifford Pinchot National Forest on Mount St. Helens. Permission was granted to the Canadian mining company Ascot USA to take 63 rock samples. The exploratory mining is intended to search for gold, copper, and molybdenum. The mining exploration has been a contentious issue for many years. It was initially dismissed by a judge in 2015 for presenting a lack of studies into environmental impacts. This area contains the headwaters of the Green River, which is a sensitive area for endangered salmon spawning. Water pollution and creating mines in the area is extremely seismically active area are also amongst concerns. Democratic Washington Senator Maria Cantwell has called the mining venture, quote, a short-sighted decision that undervalues the important benefits these public spaces offer both to our booming recreation economy and to families who come from near and far to enjoy their beauty, end quote.
The Public News Service is a member-supported media outlet that aims to cover issues that affect all of us, but they might not be covered by mainstream news. On today's News Roundup, former President George Bush's funeral, Congress is extending the deadline on the budget, and there's still time for the public to comment on proposed green card restrictions for people who have received benefits, such as receiving food stamps.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, December 6, 2018. I'm Mary Sherman. Family, friends, and a nation bid goodbye to the 41st president. Also on the Thursday rundown, concerns mount about Trump's proposed public charge rule for green cards, and California lawmakers poised to defend against federal environmental rollbacks. Our top story, the life and public service of America's 41st president were celebrated at Washington National Cathedral on Wednesday. Five former presidents were on hand to say goodbye to George H.W. Bush, as well as current President Donald Trump. George W. Bush, the 43rd president, gave the last of four eulogies and spoke of his father's unconditional love for family and his commitment to the nation.
He strongly believed that it was important to give back to the community and country in which one lived. He recognized that serving others enriched the giver's soul. To us, his was the brightest of a thousand points of light.
administration has already repealed dozens of environmental rules, from protections for wetlands and smaller streams to regulating the release of greenhouse gases from oil and gas wells on federal land. Kim Delfino with Defenders of Wildlife says California can't just stand by when Congress or federal agencies cave to special interests.
This bill was introduced to provide a backstop within state law so that if further weakening occurs, that we can continue to rely on the fact that we will have clean air, clean water, and protections for endangered species in California.
Other federal rollbacks under discussion would weaken car emission standards that reduce air pollution, sonic testing rules meant to help marine mammals, and habitat conservation measures. President Donald Trump has said environmental controls are excessive, strangle commercial activity, and cost jobs.
A coalition of conservation groups want the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to phase out wintertime efforts to feed the elk at the Jackson Hole National Elk Refuge. The groups are concerned that elk feeding in large groups could worsen the spread of lethal chronic wasting disease, which was recently detected for the first time in the region but not yet in the refuge. Timothy Prezzo, an attorney with Earth Justice, says the feeding program makes it more likely that the malady will spread.
Chronic wasting disease is transmitted by these abnormal proteins that get into the soil and into the vegetation, and there's really no known means to eradicate them, so that literally the refuge would become a disease infection zone for elk that come back to graze.
Earth Justice, along with a few other groups, sent a letter this week to the service urging the agency to phase out the winter feeding plan and let the elk forage in their natural habitat. A new report from the Idaho Department of Land says there hasn't been widespread violations of constitutional limits on state land sales, but it still flags 166 possible infractions. The story from Eric Tagetoff.
Last year, the Wilderness Society and Idaho Conservation League raised alarms that there may have been 300 violations of state limits on the number of acres it can sell to a single individual or entity, prompting a 21-month review from the IDL. Brad Brooks with the Wilderness Society says the 166 possible violations on state lands are alarming, especially as some state politicians push for transfer of federal public lands to the state.
It's a cautionary tale about what could happen if we were to give public lands that are currently used by all Idahoans for hunting, for fishing, for biking, for ATV riding. That access, which we currently enjoy, could potentially be threatened if those lands are given away to the state.
State law limits selling state-owned public schools lands to 320 acres and university lands to 160 acres. The IDL reviewed nearly 40,000 transactions and say half the flag deals took place before 1916, and all of them before 1983. The agency says there may have been different legal interpretations for land sale limitations by the state in the past.
I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for newsing and cruising with us here at Public News Service, member and listener-supported and online at publicnewsservice.org.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, a petition claims that Canadian mines upstream from the Alaskan Native land violates the human rights of the people living there. And an Albuquerque superintendent is apologizing after a former teacher was recorded insulting a Native American student and cutting another's hair. Here's more.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canadian mines upstream from southeast Alaska violate human rights of tribal members, according to a petition filed Wednesday by 15 Alaska tribes and Earth Justice. It calls on the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to investigate a half dozen mines, four developed and two planned, saying they threaten wild habitat key to the tribe's livelihood and culture. Transboundary mining has long been controversial. The Mount Polley mine disaster in 2014 discharged millions of gallons of mine waste in northern British Columbia, which has shared watershed with southeast Alaska. The mine's owner was never fined and mining resumed. Critics say the incident highlights potential dangers.
We're trying to elevate this to an international level just so we have a little more legal tools.
Jennifer Hanlon is the Yakutat-based vice chair of the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission.
For us, this is beyond an environmental issue because of our relationship and cultural identity really revolves around our relationship to our ancestral lands and waters. And for us, this is certainly a human rights issue that can't really be addressed adequately in either a Canadian or American legal system.
The filing asks the Human Rights Commission to investigate. The commission's recommendations would be non-binding. Albuquerque Public Schools Superintendent Raquel Reedy issued an apology Wednesday night as members of the Native American community packed the city's school board meeting. The Native community is continuing to put pressure on the New Mexico School District after an October 31st incident where a now former teacher is accused of calling a student a bloody Indian and cutting another student's braid.
I want to offer a heartfelt apology on behalf of APS and on my behalf for any pain caused by the events that transpired at Cibola High School.
26 people spoke during the public forum in support of the Native students. Two female parents came out to support the former teacher. They were met with disapproval from the crowd.
I could think of negative things to say about the other side, and I'm not going to. I'm just here to support.
Racist!
Members of the Native community criticized officials for not taking immediate action. They also urged for future improvements district-wide, including the creation of Native American studies. Demetrius Johnson is the brother of the student who was called a bloody Indian.
We're so tired of not having our history, our voices heard within the curriculum, especially since we are on indigenous land. No matter where you go in the United States, it's indigenous land. And for our history to be covered up for so long, like, we're tired of it. And nothing's going to get better until people start acknowledging, like, indigenous people are here, that we're not invisible, that we exist. Letting these administrators, the staff, the teachers partake in some sort of cultural awareness, sensitivity training, those are the things that we want.
The superintendent says the incident shows the district needs to revisit strategies to create a more accepting environment. APS would not confirm if the teacher was fired or resigned, saying it's a personnel issue, and only that the relationship with the teacher was severed. This week, Ruth Buffalo was sworn in, becoming the first Native American Democratic woman in the North Dakota legislature. She has worked on Native American issues and advocated for action on missing and murdered indigenous women and girls. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1907. That was the day an explosion rocked Fairmont Coal Company's number 6 and number 8 coal mines in Monaga, West Virginia, killing 367 miners. Newspaper reports estimated the number of dead to be as high as 500. It is considered the worst mine disaster in the history of the United States. Most miners were killed instantly, as the explosion destroyed the mine entrance and its ventilation system. Those not killed instantly suffocated from poisonous gas. Earth tremors were felt 8 miles away. The force of the explosion buckled pavement, collapsed buildings, and derailed streetcars. More than 3,200 miners had died in 1907. There were 3 more mine disasters before the end of the year. The last month became known as Black December. In January, a coroner's jury verdict ruled that a blowout shot ignited coal dust and made a number of recommendations for safer practices. But David McAteer tells a different story in his history of the disaster. He argues that the tipple had a design flaw that led to occasional coal car derailments as they exited the mine. And on this day, there had been a derailment with coal cars crashing at the bottom of the shaft and taking out the electrical and ventilation systems with it, igniting the coal dust in the process. The disaster generated a surge in demands for greater mine safety, leading to the creation of the Bureau of Mines in 1910. The Bureau could conduct research and safety training, but were powerless to conduct inspections or safety enforcement. Miners would continue to fight for the better part of the century for safety regulations and enforcement. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth recording of Oregon-based playwright, author, and actor Octavio Solis telling stories of a life lived along the border and its impact on Mexicans and Mexican-Americans. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio coming at you, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio, Tonight's weather here in Portland will have some clear skies with a low around a chilly 29 degrees below freezing, followed by mostly cloudy weather tomorrow, and then a high in the upper 30s to low 40s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, there's a slight chance of some light precipitation with temperatures in the upper 30s. On this date in history, Italian musician, composer, and lawyer Piero Piccioni was born in 1921. He started his career on the radio in big band jazz. His band was the first jazz to be played on the airwaves after the fall of fascism in the year 1944. He went to become a lawyer for movie distributors. His close connections in film led him to drop his career and start scoring films during the heyday of Italian films. And then our quote of the day comes from Audre Lorde. I am deliberate and afraid of nothing.
On today's Week in Water, brought to us by H2O Radio, we hear about a pork farm that is trying to combat carbon emissions, the potential scarcity of groundwater, and how we can keep coral reefs alive in spite of rising sea temperatures.
A new way to detect pipeline leaks. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
In an effort to combat climate change and heat homes, the world's largest producer of pork is partnering with an energy company to capture methane gas from waste lagoons.
The Washington Post reports that Smithfield Foods and Dominion Energy plan to cover hog waste pits in Virginia, North Carolina, and Utah, and eventually feed the methane into existing pipelines.
Emissions from agriculture in the U.S. represent nearly 10% of greenhouse gases. Methane has a shorter lifespan than carbon dioxide, but it is 25 times as potent.
By covering the lagoons, it could also keep water from inundating them, which happened during Hurricane Florence when breached pits sent waste into streams and rivers.
The plans are not without critics. Food and Water Watch says on its website that there will still be leftover waste that will be sprayed or spread on lands. The organization says that the Smithfield plans are an effort to greenwash factory farms.
Recently, a jury awarded more than $475 million to be paid by Smithfield to six families in North Carolina because of the noise and odor from hog farming.
During times of drought, some water providers drill deeper into the ground to obtain supplies. Groundwater sits in layers, and at lower levels it becomes brackish or salty and is not potable.
A new study published in the journal Environmental Research Letters shows that there might not be as much drinkable groundwater as we thought. They found that brackish waters are closer to the surface, particularly in the Midwest and further east.
About 40% of all the water used in the U.S. for irrigated agriculture comes from groundwater, and some cities depend on it.
The scientists concluded that in Michigan or Ohio, groundwater is too saline to be an option when supplies are stressed.
The authors say their study also shows that groundwater is being reduced not only by excessive withdrawals, but also by injecting wastewater from fracking and potential contamination from oil and gas development.
The researchers conclude that drilling deeper is not a long-term solution to the demand for additional fresh water.
Coral reefs have declined up to 50% in all oceans over the last 40 years, and a new report from the National Academy of Sciences outlines strategies that might be needed to save them.
One method is to develop a so-called super coral that could survive hot water bleaching events, which can kill the reefs. They also hope the super corals could withstand more acidic waters.
Another solution would be to pump up cooler water from the ocean depths in a feat of geoengineering.
As the news site Earther describes, another option calls for coral embryos and sperm to be frozen and then thawed out when the climate is hopefully cooler.
Mark Eakin of Coral Reef Watch said that these solutions are not supposed to replace efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but instead, it's what's needed to repair and keep reefs alive despite global warming.
Leaks in pipes that carry water to homes and businesses waste about 6 billion gallons of water per day in the U.S., according to a recent study. So engineers are working on ways to detect them.
Some methods to find leaks use robots, like a device resembling a badminton shuttlecock that runs down a pipe. Another solution uses a handheld probe with a sensor that is placed against a pipe that can lead investigators to a leak.
But researchers from the University of Waterloo in Ontario have recently invented a novel solution. They've designed a system of sensors that's inexpensive and easy to install in fire hydrants, even without taking them out of service.
A release from the university explains that the sensors gather acoustic data that highlights leaks. Artificial intelligence software then develops algorithms to distinguish leaks from all the other noises in a water distribution system.
Researchers are now field testing the hydrant sensors in Canada, where leaky pipes lose an average of more than 13% of their treated water before it reaches users. And finally, Puffin Island sits off the coast of Wales, and it's uninhabited except for a lot of seabirds that call it home, one of which is the razorbill, a black and white bird similar to a puffin. Razorbills spend more of their time at sea than on land, and that presented an opportunity for science.
Researcher Matt Cooper from Bangor University in Wales had fitted GPS tags on the razorbills to study their breeding and feeding behaviors when he discovered that at night, the creatures just hung out on the ocean surface, simply going wherever the tide took them.
And after recording the bird's position every 100 seconds, he was able to see that the razorbills were not only drifting with the currents, they followed the direction of low and high tides, a discovery that he realized could be really useful for developing tidal energy.
Generating energy from tide flows requires detailed knowledge of sea currents, which scientists and engineers have traditionally determined using radar or buoys with scientific instruments. But those methods are challenging and expensive, so if tagged seabirds could provide tidal data over a large area, it might help to locate a good site to place turbines.
Ocean energy, which is being generated mostly in the UK, is seen by many as a promising renewable and a way to phase out fossil fuels. According to Forbes magazine, environmental impact studies of tidal power have shown relatively little effect on ecosystems. However, researchers at Cardiff University have concerns that it could negatively affect marine life by changing how sedimentation, dissolved oxygen, and nutrients circulate in the area. They say more study is needed.
And Cooper says using seabirds to measure tidal currents has limitations since, well, they are birds behaving naturally, but even so, he thinks that tracking their movements could tell us more about our oceans, especially in remote regions where getting data is challenging.
This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Explore new trends in technology at ACE 19, June 9th through 12th in Denver. Learn more at awwaace.org.
The Middle East Minute Plus is a daily roundup of the biggest issues coming out of the Middle East. On today's episode, a video has been released showing an Israeli soldier tear-gassing a Palestinian schoolyard. In collaboration with Jewish Voices for Peace and KPFK, here's more in Middle East Minute Plus.
I'm Esti Chandler for the Middle East Minute Plus. A video obtained by Israel's Haaretz newspaper today shows an Israeli soldier shooting tear gas into a Palestinian schoolyard during school hours in the occupied West Bank city of Hebron. In response to an inquiry by Haaretz to the Israeli military last week, an army spokesperson claimed the military doesn't launch stun grenades or tear gas into schools. However, the video, which was taken on November 18th outside a boys' school, countered that claim. Last week, Palestinians reported to Israeli anti-occupation NGO Breaking the Silence an increase in the incidence of tear gas launched into schools, including primary schools, with teachers telling Haaretz that Israeli troops throw canisters at the boys' school on a daily basis. A photo published by Haaretz shows a box with dozens of used grenades and canisters, which the school manager says were thrown into the school over the past couple of months. many of them resembling tear gas made in the USA and provided to the Israeli military via credits with American weapons manufacturers purchased with American tax dollars. Ron Zaidel, director of research for Breaking the Silence, said, "While thousands of Palestinian students are suffocating from tear gas, the Israeli military spokesperson is trying to put up a smoke screen to hide the reality on the ground from the public." Zaidel said, "The thousands of testimonies collected by the group over the years, quote, clearly show that violence against children is an unavoidable part of the military dictatorship ruling a civilian population," end quote. Following Haaretz's release of the video, the Israeli army spokesperson was forced to confirm the incident. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
A high-profile government critic and leading opposition figure in Rwanda has been acquitted of politically motivated charges by the East African country's High Court. Diane Rwigara, who tried to run against Rwanda's longtime president Paul Kagame, was accused of insurrection and signature forgery in a case that drew national attention. A panel of three judges ruled the accusations as baseless. Rwigara's mother, Adeline, was also acquitted. Kagame was first elected in 1994, and while he has been praised for some reforms, he is accused of extreme authoritarianism and has a history of jailing political opposition. Rwigara said that she was very happy with the verdict, but vowed to continue her journey, citing the fact there are still many political prisoners in the country.
The Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division is asking for our help to try to find the person responsible for trespassing, vandalism, and theft of salmon and ODFW equipment at the Bull Run River Fish Trap in Clackamas County. They took a photo of one of the suspects, and the Oregon State Police are requesting that anyone with information about who the person is to please contact Senior Trooper Mark Klingma at 503-779-3623, and they remind you to report wildlife and habitat law violators. There are cash rewards through what's called the TIPS program, including $100 for game fish and shellfish taken illegally. You can contact the TIP hotline, 1-800-452-7888, or you can email them at tip@state.oregon.us. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 6, 2018. Here are some of the main stories again. A man who used to live in Portland was found guilty of abusing young children in a case lawyers describe as one of the worst they have ever seen. Three tracksuit bandits get prison time for a crime spree in Multnomah and Clackamas counties, targeting nine convenience stores. And warming shelters are open in our community as people get ready for temperatures to drop below freezing overnight. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with our breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Oliver Minslow, Grace Ann Smith, Annette Newell, Aiden Moyer, and Teresa Mitchell. The producer is Grace Ann Smith, and our engineer is Aiden Moyer. The news director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast are available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani takes your calls. At 9, Pacific Underground welcomes Peter Turias and talks about his alternative history novels, United States of Japan and Meicha Samurai Empire. At 11, at 10, Valley View celebrates its one-year anniversary on KBOO with stories about the show's origin and plans for a future format. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, a Radio Geekly looks back at the life of publisher Stan Lee, visits the local holiday craft fair, Geek the Halls, and a visit to the D&D pop-up tavern, Orcs, Orcs, Orcs. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Octavio Solis is an author and playwright who lives in rural Oregon, but much of his work is about the place, El Paso, and people he grew up around, many of them Mexican immigrants, whose struggles he captures in his work. Last night he did a reading at Powell's Bookstore in Portland from his newest book, a collection of short stories entitled Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border. Here's part of his reading from a story called Keening.
Mom is making coffee. No, she's stirring soup in a stew pot, steaming hot. Sitting down behind her, that's not my dad, but some man in an old straw cowboy hat with a frayed brim and dirty hat band. An older, darker man. Tufts of gray in his mustache. He's sitting at our kitchen table, leaning close into another person, a younger woman bundled up in blankets and serapes, shivering violently. This is where the crying is coming from, that faint, almost whispered wail. The man is consoling her with hoarse words I can't make out. My mom says, "What are you doing up? Go to bed. Go to bed now." "Who are they?" I ask. "Nobody," she says. "Go to bed," she says. I look down at the woman's feet, and they are bare and dirty and raw and red and shivering like mad, too. I see her face, and my immediate impression is that she is ugly, her braided black hair framing an ugly face, all red, covered in frozen snot. Her fingers all swollen and red, too. They're both shaking with cold and maybe fear and maybe something else, some sickness they contracted just by being in our house. The man is saying, "Cálmate, ya mero llegamos," which means they're leaving soon. My mom reaches into the stew pot with a pair of tongs and takes small towels out, and then wringing them over the sink, sets them on the table where the man places them on the woman's hands and feet. There's a bundle of wet clothes tied with baling wire by the back door. Also a pair of boots, soggy tennies, and some balled up socks. I feel my sister come in behind me, then my brother. My mother turns to us and explains that they are nice people and that they just need a little help. "What kind of help?" I ask. The back door opens and my dad comes in with snow flurries on his shoulders and his cap. He's been warming up the sedan outside. His face is clenched with worry as he looks down on the huddled pair. He asks the old man something, and the older man gives him a small folded up piece of paper. The woman is still crying and shaking her head like she's counting down a whole life's worth of mistakes. Mom says to me, "Pour them some coffee." And I get the old percolator and two cups. My hand is shaking as I pour. I put the cups on the table, and the woman turns her ugly face to me and whispers in the same keening tone, "Gracias." While they drink their coffee, my dad tells the man in Spanish that they picked a bad night to cross. "Every night is bad," he replies. My dad looks at the paper one more time and says, "We should go." They put their socks and shoes on, and they try to return the blankets to my mom, but she won't take them. Again, the woman says, "Gracias." She stands, and I see then that she is pregnant. They pull the blankets up to their faces and start for the door. They follow my dad outside into the freezing snow. I can hear the loud motor of the car readying itself for some mission, then hear it shifting into reverse. My mom closes the door, latches it, and says, "Ya, se acabó. Go to bed." We all go to bed shivering with some of their cold and some of their fear, and I fall asleep almost instantly and dream of a clay-colored woman with a figurine baby keening in the night. That's one. We were raised in a house about half a mile from the Rio Grande, and there we grew up with Border Patrol cruisers going day and night, all the time looking for border crossers. We saw undocumented people who wandered around right past our house like ghosts at night, trying to find their destination. And in this case with Keening, two of them happened to knock on my parents' house because they were lost. It's strange because it hardly ever snows in El Paso, but this night was a particularly inclement time, very cold, very snowy. And that moment has stayed with me. I'm going to read another one. It's called World Goes Away. This one is about my time in El Paso when I was first introduced to the theater. I'm a theater artist. It's what I've done all my life. And when I landed in that world, I instantly knew this was what I would do for the rest of my life. And I've done it. Been a playwright for 35 years, an actor for probably a little longer than that, although it's been a long time since I've acted. And I didn't ever imagine that I'd make an entire career of it, but I'm, by virtue of just sticking to it, I've lasted this long. But this is about that first moment. It's one of those sacred moments that also felt so dreamlike to me, and it's called World Goes Away. I was in high school at the time, sophomore. I'm in disbelief. I'm at a loss to explain how I got here. It's my first week as a sophomore, and instead of enjoying the afternoon watching TV and doing my homework at my leisure, I'm at the first reading of a play in my school, The Diary of Anne Frank. All these poor idiots sitting in a circle with me are wondering how they got here too. Some of them pleased as punch. Others with the same perplexed look that's plastered on my face. We're assembled in the auditorium, which also passes for the basketball court and gymnasium, listening to our drama coach laying down the laws of daily rehearsal. Miss Griffin is a feisty West Texan, short and sturdy, with close-cropped hair and glasses, and she's calmly setting forth the hours and days we'll be working and underscoring her expectations of us as actors. She's grinning all smug, because she knows some of us will defy these expectations, for which she's got gallons of two-fisted fury saved up in her compact frame. For now, just her bearing is enough to keep us in line. All I'm thinking is, my afternoons are shot to hell forever. What's worse is that now she has us holding hands and bowing our heads in for prayer circle. She's calling for Jesus to bless our production, assuring him that we're only here to do his will, even though the play is about Jews in Nazi Europe. I'm confused and dismayed as this cycle of prayer goes on for a full 15 minutes, with other students chiming in their amens and yes, fathers. If this is going to happen every time we meet for play practice, then I'm done. I'm already suffocating with all this sudden godliness, all these rules, all the hours wasted in a cavernous gym with this tough
we are the tribe
crying hallelujah. I don't know how she managed to get me to agree to be in this show, but I'm shaking out of this obligation quick. I resolve to sit through this one session with as good an attitude as I can muster up, but when it's over, it's over. I'm not coming back. Not even if I'm playing Peter Van Damme, one of the young leads in the play. I don't care. Let him find someone else. Finally, with everyone ready and worked up on Jesus, we take our seats in the circle as Miss Griffin passes out the scripts. She reminds us who's playing what role and directs us to read loudly, with feeling and enunciation. That last word is new to me, but it sounds pretty religious. We open the scripts and begin reading. And gradually, with the first girl's voice taking on the words of Anne Frank, the physics in the room begin to change. I feel the voice of this dark, long-haired Mexican schoolgirl peel away the walls of the gym to reveal wartime Amsterdam. And then I see Anne herself huddled with her diary in the secret attic of her tragic story. Within the empty space of the circle, other voices around me lay down the vivid action of the play with passion, energy, and conviction. And then it's my turn. Some impulse takes over, and I'm not me anymore, but Peter Van Damme, aching for sunlight and a place of no fear and the love of a young girl. The words go in my eyes and come out my mouth with more heart than I thought I had. And in that moment, the school and the impossible classloads and the gangs that chased me on the way home and the border patrol and the tensions of home and my personal anxieties about who I am and all the lived experience that make my town, this unspectacular, sporadically dangerous place, simply go away. I am somewhere in the mind of a teenage girl who disappeared into the death camps, inhabiting her words like they're the only world that matters. When we get to the end, our Anne is openly crying as a mournful hush falls over us. I'm bewildered. I want to know how this happened, how we made the world vanish for these few hours of reading. After we stand and hold hands one more time for an adjourning prayer, Miss Griffin comes over to me while I'm gathering up my homework and getting ready to leave. She obviously senses my confusion. With my eyes on the script, I want to tell her it's a miracle. This play is a miracle. How it made all the people and things, all my cares and worries of my world, evaporate to nothing. But she beats me to it, saying, "Well, you're still here." I look at her. I want to ask what she means. She smiles that smug smile and goes to switch off the gymnasium lights, and I walk home in the dark. But I'll be back, script in hand, to find my heart again. Now I'd like to read one called The Want. It takes place later in my life. I think I was maybe in college already. It's my, I guess, the closest to a Christmas story I come in these metaphors. The Want. First Christmas back from college in El Paso is a stark and lonely place. My dad's asleep in his easy chair. Mom's got the caldo de pollo simmering on the stove for me. But something else simmers in my private heart, a carnal wanting that grinds me down, an unquiet urge slowly reaming me out. I'm locked in my room, poring over my high school yearbook, studying the florid signatures of all my pretty classmates beseeching me to call whenever I'm in town, hearts for punctuation, smiley faces dotting the I's. Too sweet to be forgotten. What can they possibly mean except you are forgotten already? Dad knocks on the door and asks if I'm okay. I tell him I'm going to see a friend. But it's late, he says. Not late for me. It's 10:30, he says. That's early, I tell him. When they're in bed, I take the keys and I go. The roads are quiet. The sky is overcast. Bing Crosby on the radio wants to make me cry. I follow the city lodestar there on the Franklin Mountains, the giant five-pointed pentagram of bright electric bulbs that light up every Christmas. I pull into a bar to drink, but it's strange sitting by myself with all these older, blinder boozers who can hardly finish a sentence. So I leave. I don't want a drink. I don't need a drink. I need a girl. Some girl to lie to, hold, feel against me. Someone to give me a little nighttime CPR, for God's sake. just one time, one night. That's all. The loneliness is hurting really bad now. It's not in the heart, but in the head, like a migraine shooting icicles into the back of my eyes. It's in my throat too, sore with the whispers that keep hissing out of my mouth like bile. All around me, the streets are barren and shiny in the night, all mortals hidden, out of reach. This is what my born-again high school teacher said would happen. You abandon the Lord, and you'll feel the desolation of that choice. You'll be more alone than you could ever imagine. Painful and paralyzing is the sinner's harrowing. It's about 2 a.m. A purgatory of empty streets. At every intersection, a population of one. What am I looking for? Who do I hope to see?
That was Oregon-based author and playwright Octavio Solis reading from his new book, Retablos, Stories from a Life Lived Along the Border.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:59. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the Streets.
You are listening to a digital indigenous radio show. All across Turtle Island, turn up your radios.